This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Vicki Barker. Massive recovery and repair material converging on the waters around the collapsed Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore. The largest crane on the eastern seaboard is going to be aiding the effort, but it may be months before the port of Baltimore can reopen. Meanwhile, Jim Salmon of the Delaware River Bay Authority says that state is taking steps to protect one of its major bridges. CBS's Stephen Stock has been talking to him. I'm sorry. Let me try introducing Stephen Stock again.
The state is spending $95 million installing up-to-date protections on the Delaware Memorial Bridge.
If a ship would happen to lose control or lose steering and veer towards one of our tower structures, these new dolphin cells will protect our tower structures. It's what I would call our insurance policy.
That insurance policy with new reinforced structures might have made Tuesday's crash less catastrophic. The changes to the Delaware Memorial Bridge are meant to withstand a collision with a ship heavier and moving faster than the Dolly when it hit the Key Bridge.
Pope Francis was a last-minute no-show at a key Easter ritual last night. He is expected to be able to celebrate Easter Mass tomorrow. Anti-Israel protests in Jordan again today, with demonstrators calling for an end to Israel's attacks in Gaza and the slowdown of aid, threatening famine there. This week, Israel announced it would stop working with UNRWA, the UN agency helping Palestinians in Gaza, after some of its workers were implicated in the October 7th massacres in Israel. CBS's Chris Livesay has
more. The UN is investigating the allegations against its staff, which it fired immediately. That's 12 people out of 30,000 throughout the region. And what the director of the West Bank office of UNRWA told me is that there simply is no other organization in the region with either the resources or the personnel to take its place.
And a United flight from Tel Aviv to Newark was diverted to a small New York State airport last night after hitting severe high winds and turbulence. CBS travel editor Peter Greenberg with this reality check.
Flights get diverted all the time. United Airlines, by the end of this month, which is fast approaching, will have had 131,000 departures and only 9 incidents, none of which were life-threatening.
Try telling that to the passengers involved. The flight did resume, but some of them opted to complete their journey by bus. This is CBS News.
Think O'Reilly Auto Parts for all your car care needs. Get the parts and service you need fast from the professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Some people, mainly older Americans with disabilities, are eligible for both Medicare and Medicaid. Outreach efforts are helping eligible people in Wisconsin sign up. Mike Moan reports.
Only about 3 in 10 people who qualify for dual-eligible special needs plans were enrolled in 2021. Experts say the option is designed for people who need additional help because of disabilities, certain health conditions, or their age. Dr. Gina Williams with United Healthcare says these plans try to take a dynamic approach to serving those eligible.
Everything from managing your wellness to managing your behavioral health needs and then everyday needs. So it's kind of a more comprehensive package for people who need a little bit more support.
Those everyday needs she mentioned include meal benefits and bathroom safety devices. Wisconsin's enrollment numbers are similar to the national rate, coming in at 28%. Christine Huberty with the Greater Wisconsin Agency on Aging Resources says a tricky component of these plans is navigating provider network restrictions. A rural resident might have to travel farther to see a doctor covered under the plan, and she says that warrants careful research when enrolling.
I would say first and foremost, look at the provider network restrictions and look at what's available in your area.
Meanwhile, Williams says the push to get more eligible people to sign up coincides with more awareness about preventative care in a post-pandemic world.
They're not only thinking about acute illness, but they're thinking about overall care. Like, what was the impact of the pandemic from a psychological standpoint? Do you need more support? And then do you also need more coordination of benefits?
This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
Monday on Nightlight, On Stage for Cancer performs live, and I'm joined by filmmaker Mark Garvey. It's Nightlight from 7 to 9 p.m. on the Civic Media Radio Network.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, showers and maybe a thunderstorm, a high near 49. Mostly cloudy tonight with a low around 35. More rain possible on Sunday, cloudy skies, 46. Rain likely Sunday night with a low around 38. For Monday, more rain, breezy, and 46.
Right now, it's 37.
Waukesha, home of Les Paul, our awesome farmers market, and The Shaw, 540 AM and 101.1 FM, WAUK.
Welcome to our weekly, our weekend broadcast. My name is Jim Santel, and yes, this is Amicus a Law Review, our weekly examination of major events in our state, our nation, and our world, having to do with law, government, courts, and the delivery, the aspiration for justice in our land and beyond. This hour, as last hour, talking again about courts in America. In the end of our first hour on this broadcast, talking a lot about this decision by the appeals court in New York to reduce the amount that Donald Trump is required to place as a bond as he appeals the nearly half a billion judgment entered against him by the New York court based upon the valuations case against him. I've always promised in the past that we do some a little bit more analysis of those kinds of things under a heading called Law Review Case Notes, and this is where we're going to begin that process. Important to understand what is going on here. Yes, indeed, the appeals court does have the authority, the responsibility, if you will, to decide on petitions like this one to reduce a bond. But what are the other tea leaves that we read from this? Well, you look at that and you think, gee, if there's an appeals court that is already somewhat receptive to the Donald Trump petitions, although they're not ruling directly on the merits, the substance of the appeal itself, this ruling in which they reduce dramatically, significantly, the amount of bond suggests that some of those judges, some of the five appellate judges on the New York appellate court, some of them could be very sympathetic to Donald Trump's case. And in fact, more suggestions of that come in connection with the other things that they did that have sort of run under the radar on this. As I said before, Justice Engoron, in addition to imposing this huge judgment on Donald Trump, also imposed some restrictions on him and his family. He barred him from running a New York company, obtaining a loan from a New York bank for about 3 years, and those same restrictions also apply to his adult sons. Significantly, Judge or Justice Engoron also extended the appointment of an independent monitor, who is this fairly watchful outsider to keep an eye on the family business, to get authorizations for any major actions through the monitor before those can be done. All of that a part of Judge or Justice Engoron's judgment in this case. In addition to reducing the bond, the appeals court also paused, put on hold, virtually all of those restrictions as well. All of those restrictions also imposed by Justice Engoron, suspended and put in abeyance, if you will, until the full appeal is heard. The only part of that order that the court endorsed and kept in place was the presence and the work of this outsider, the monitor that is keeping the eye once again on the family business, determining what kinds of transactions can and cannot be pursued. All of that to suggest, from the perspective of people who know a lot about Donald Trump's finances, and generally from perspectives of people who follow appeals and how these things work, that indeed the appeals court may be very sympathetic to ultimately reducing the amount of the overall judgment when it comes to the merits, the actual wrestling with the legitimacy of the judgment itself. It will be months, it may be years before we see what the appeals court does. And we don't know for sure if the five appellate court judges who made this decision to reduce the bond and also take away these other limitations on Donald Trump and his sons and the company generally, we don't know if those are going to be the same judges who decide the actual appeal. But it certainly indicates that inside the Court of Appeals, there is certainly some sympathy, some attraction, if you will, to Donald Trump's position that the $454 million judgment, actually now much more in excess of that, should be reduced in some way. Time will tell. And the process itself involving, again, the filing of briefs, oral arguments to the appeals court, all of that will result ultimately in a decision. We anticipate probably this coming week that Donald Trump, through his savior company, will post the $175 million bond and effectively perfect and accomplish that appeal to the Court of Appeals. We'll continue to monitor that issue here on Amicus, a Law Review, as always. And as always, taking your phone calls, Anya and I are at 855-752-4842. That number once again, 855-752-4842. Before we go on to other things happening in courts, state courts in our nation, we're delighted to have callers, as always. And Joe calling in from Madison, thrilled to have you with us this morning as well.
Thanks, Jim. I appreciate all the detail and the scrupulousness in which you present this. It's very helpful. I wanted to ask your thoughts and reflections, and I'll hang up after my question. And it does have to do with this court case that you're speaking of now, in which the bond has been reduced for Trump by hundreds of millions of dollars prior to what he was told that he had to arrive at. You speak of the fact that this appellate court may be sympathetic to Donald Trump, yet there's nothing indicating why they would need that sympathy. For example, somebody suggested, well, these cases are complicated, thus it's, how he extracts the money out of his various investments is difficult, and so maybe they were sympathetic for that reason. I think the problem is, for average citizen, they look at that and they think, hey, people I know who were in trouble and had to post bond got no break at all on what they were doing. They were told, this is your bond, do it. And, no argument. You can't just argue it away or go appeal it. And it's this interesting thing in terms of two-tier justice and in terms of how it looks. And because the appeals court offered no reasons for why they dropped this dramatically, and I understand, it's not done yet and there's more in the future, but it still has the appearance, I think, for the average person of, gee, nice deal. I guess it pays to be rich, words to that effect. Can you just offer your thoughts on this? And I mean, my concern is that there's an erosion for the respect of the court if people know, well, rich people are just going to get away with it.
And Joe, appreciate the comment and the question, the inquiry, with which I concur. It is about the appearance. We talk a lot about that on this broadcast. And although, yes, this can be viewed as sort of an interim decision, reducing this bond, as you indicate, Joe, is it important? You bet it is. It's hugely significant in the overall management of this case. And I would concur entirely in this area and in other areas we'll talk about a little bit later in this hour, that Donald Trump gets some consideration that certainly is not available to an awful lot of other people who are out there who likewise, whether they're seeking to pursue something on appeal, seeking reductions in their bond. And oh, by the way, even saying things outside of court about the pendency of their cases, their trials. I'm going to talk about these orders being entered by trial court judges as well, trying to restrict him. All these kinds of things where Donald Trump does and says things that others based upon wealth, based upon status, based upon notoriety, do not get the benefit of. And that's the problem, Joe, as you just identified, for the perception of a court that gives people who have some wealth, who have some status, have some notoriety, considerations that in the state of Wisconsin, in the state courts, even the appellate courts, in the federal courts here in Wisconsin and throughout the nation, normally people do not get this kind of consideration. I agree with you. And while we'll have to read the tea leaves as the appeals court goes forward and manages this case even more, the notion that they might be signaling already some concern about the underlying case and the legitimacy of Justice Engoron's judgment is also concerning. Those are the kinds of things that you wait for an appeals court to decide, pursue on oral argument, pursue in the course of their orders themselves. All of this sends some signals that again, I think, as do you as well, I suspect other listeners similarly feel the same way, that while it is unusual, admittedly, to have a dollar judgment entered against you, very few of us, if any of us beyond Donald Trump, have that particular experience. It is in the interest of equity and equitable justice and the delivery of justice that prompts us to think, would I get that same consideration if I was in a like, if not exactly the same situation? The concern is legitimate. And courts need to be attentive to that. We talk a lot about the Supreme Court's present reputation. They need to be concerned, first and foremost, of course, about the law and the application of the facts to it, but also need to be perceptive of the world in which they live. And Joe, your comments about this erosion in the perception of what judges are doing in America, it is a consideration for all of us as we think about how we elect judges, who we elect to those positions, what judges are also appointed in the federal system as well. All of that, a reason to be focused on the judiciary in ways that perhaps we have not done in years past. Joe, thank you so much for the comment. As always, insightful and important. Bill, also calling in this morning. Bill, appreciate your question or your inquiry this morning on Amicus, a law review.
Great topic. My question is this. Do you not think that Trump's attorneys are now, besides him, are held to a level of accountability? Because if you bring in a criminal and he just perjures himself and makes false statements, how much does this have on their attorneys and their commitment to their bar and the standards they held up? I'll hang up. I want your opinion.
Terrific insight once again, Bill. Thank you for calling in. Appreciate this. And again, anticipating some more discussions here. Perhaps I can simply say at this point that, yes, the integrity of the attorneys who appear in front of courts and judges is always at the top of the list. I always say that lawyers have two things. We have words, both written and also oral, and we've got integrity. And you take away either one of those, you no longer have lawyers, right? Judges look to attorneys to be straightforward with them, to be factual, to provide them with the truth, even if that truth is not necessarily supportive of their client's position. That's what's called being an officer of the court. Every single time I appear in front of court, a criminal court, a civil court, I am an officer of the court, and the ethics rules require that regardless of my advocacy for my client, and again, the ethics rules contemplate vigorous advocacy, even sometimes aggressive advocacy, I can never depart from the facts. I should not be representing to the judge or judges at the trial court level, appellate court level, things that are not true. When I do that, I not only run afoul of the basic ethic rules, but I also violate my oath to the court itself to be an officer of the court. We're going to spend some time talking about what one does when you've got a client like this, as you just indicated, who does engage in activities that brings the reputation of their lawyers along for the ride and arguably contemplates its diminution as well. We're going to do all of that as our discussion here on Amicus, a Law Review continues.
You're listening to The Shaw, WAUK, Waukesha's home for the Todd Allball Show.
As you age, you may have questions about finding transportation, healthy meals, or other services around your home and in your community. And the Elder Care Locator has the answers at 1-800-677-1116. Our caring advisors can connect you to trustworthy local experts and the support you need to age well at home. Real people, real assistance, and real connections are just a phone call away with the Elder Care Locator. 1-800-677-1116.
Nightline with Pete Schwabba.
This is National Let's Laugh Day. I think laughter is truly the best medicine. What makes you laugh the hardest? My family members, my kids are funny. My dad makes me laugh. My wife makes me laugh. Conrad makes me laugh. I think one of the most important things that we can do in life is laugh. Personally, comedy's gotten me through some very tough times. It's great therapy.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba, weeknights 7 till 9 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. This is The Shaw, WAUK.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. Bill has called in and raised this very important issue about the connection between attorneys and their clients and the kinds of things that attorneys are obliged to do when they are officers of the court, appearing in front of a judge. Aggressive advocacy, important advocacy on behalf of their clients, but cannot cross the line. And we have seen, as we will see again later in this hour of our broadcast, what happens when attorneys violate that fundamental principle. But Bill, there is also some illustration of exactly what you described coming out of yet another court, this one also in Manhattan, just this past week as well. We know that the trial of Donald Trump for the so-called hush money case, that's the case involving, brought by Alvin Bragg, the district attorney, alleging that Donald Trump violated New York law in a criminal manner. This is a criminal case when he paid so-called hush money to Stormy Daniels to keep quiet on the affair that he maintains never happened. She says it did. As a part of his effort to try to keep us from knowing about that, as I've said before, this matter, although it sounds fairly limited in its scope, is actually yet another case in the broad category of election interference, an attempt to try to undermine the election, this time of 2016. Why? Because he's trying to undermine the legitimate information that is in the public domain for people to decide upon in making their votes. What happened just this past week in this trial court presided over by Juan Merchan, M-E-R-C-H-A-N? We know that the case was scheduled to go to trial about a week or so ago. It did not do that when it turned out that about 100,000 more documents had surfaced from the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District of New York, produced by Alvin Bragg, and given over to the defense, as appropriately one has to do during the course of these criminal prosecutions. The judge, feeling obliged to permit Donald Trump, appropriately delayed the start of the trial and then had a hearing just this past Monday on what to do next. And two important things came out of that hearing on Monday about the scheduling of the trial, but also about other things having to do with the behavior of lawyers and also Donald Trump, going right back to what Bill has raised. We know that Judge Merchan, in this case, again, before him is a request by Donald Trump for a 90-day delay for the purpose of reviewing these additional documents before the trial can be resumed here. After a mid-morning break where the judge had talked to the attorneys about all this, trying to figure out what had happened, the judge came back and said fairly summarily, the defendant has been given a reasonable amount of time and rescheduled the trial to begin on April 15th, about 2 weeks from now. Doesn't give the defense a huge amount of time. That, of course, in his discretion, based upon what he has heard from the attorneys during the course of this presentation before him just this past week. Along the way, following up on Bill's comments, the judge said this. He said the defense's allegations that prosecutors had made ethical errors related to the disclosure of these documents were, and these are the judge's words, were incredibly serious. Unbelievably serious, he said. And then he scolded Trump's lawyers for failing to substantiate their claims. A classic situation, Bill, where the judge identified lawyers appearing in front of him, making allegations, making statements that were not, in fact, supported by the record. The judge went on to say this in admonishing these attorneys. He said, "You are literally accusing the Manhattan DA's office and the people assigned to this case of prosecutorial misconduct." That's no small thing. "And trying to make me," meaning the judge, "complicit in it." Those are strong words coming from any trial judge who's presiding over a case like this, admonishing the lawyers to behave, to tell them that when it comes to representations, even by a client who would like them, I'm sure, to lie and to misrepresent, that is not their role as officers of the court, and arguably setting themselves up for some review by a licensing authority. Exactly the kind of thing that Bill is talking about as Judge Merchan, number one, sets this case for a trial, dismissing the unfounded allegations of misconduct, finding the defense has enough time to review these documents, and planning for jury selection, which itself will take a couple of weeks on April 15th, which, of course, is also tax day. Now, something else happened. Something else happened during the course of this past week in the wake of that hearing, but also coming from the pen of Judge Juan Merchan, that also goes to this issue that Bill raises about the behavior of a client and the relationship with attorneys. The New York judge, again, presiding over this same criminal trial, imposed what's called, again, I always balk at this, a gag order. Did this on Tuesday. This is Juan Merchan. And let's talk for a minute about the language of these orders themselves. The media talks about these as gag orders, and they are not. To gag someone means quite literally to stop them from talking, perhaps in the most literal sense to putting a Band-Aid or some other restraint on their mouths. That's not what's going on in any of these cases. And so I always balk at and try to describe these in situations where judges look at circumstances and impose reasonable restrictions upon not only the defendant in front of them, but also upon any defendant who appears in the courts, the criminal courts of our state and of our federal government as well. There is a requirement by anyone who appears in a federal or state court to abide by the basic rules and conditions of that. And along the way, one of the things you cannot do, whether you are a state defendant, a federal defendant, either as a lawyer or as a defendant, the person who's on trial himself or herself, you cannot be out there affecting the course of the very trial in which you are the defendant. And that means you cannot threaten witnesses. You cannot suggest that people threaten them on your behalf. You cannot in some way affect the jury pool by suggesting that the evidence in the course of the trial is going to be wildly tainted. This is the product of fraud or false representations or some sort of forensic misconduct by the prosecutors. You cannot attack the people who are a part of the justice system themselves. And I offer that that includes the judges, their staff, the prosecutors, their staff, defense counsel, their staff, all the court personnel who are responsible for calling in jurors. It certainly includes the people who are those jurors and those witnesses, but it includes everyone who is responsible for delivering justice. And we know that this issue about Donald Trump being out there and saying things that tend to suggest the trial is not legitimate, that people are lying, that he has been the victim of offensive behavior by judges who are described in very colorful terms by him, attacking the prosecutors, sometimes attacking other participants, including court staff. All of that is inappropriate. And so judges, when they're presiding over these cases, are required to administer their cases in such a way to protect the ultimate legitimacy of the judgment that's going to be rendered by a jury. And so we see these so-called gag orders, again, not the word that I would use. I would call them orders that simply establish order in their courts imposed upon Donald Trump. Again, this past week in the case pending before Judge Merchan, also imposed previously by Judge Tanya Chutkan in that federal case in Washington, D.C., more of this discussion about these kinds of orders coming up and exactly what Judge Merchan did this past week to preserve justice in the trial now going ahead in his Manhattan courtroom in the middle of April.
Whether you're heading down Les Paul Parkway or fighting traffic on the interstates, this is The Shaw, 540 AM and 101.1 FM, WAUK.
CBS News Brief. Heavy equipment is moving into place in the port of Baltimore to remove debris after the Key Bridge collapse. Este Pinchazen is commander of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers.
By investing this time now in the engineering, we're going to be able to move faster later. And I know right now everyone wants to see things moving. You need to know, you need to trust that behind the scenes it's moving.
Pope Francis skipped a popular Good Friday procession of the cross in Rome. Here's CBS's Jeff Glore.
The Vatican says he skipped the traditional Good Friday procession to preserve his health ahead of Easter. He is expected to preside at an Easter vigil service today and celebrate Easter Mass tomorrow.
Spring storms are hitting parts of the West Coast. Weather Channel meteorologist Kelly Cass.
Some spots could see perhaps 3 to 5 inches of rain. And then, of course, you've got the snow that's going to be piling up across the High Sierra. We have had quite a busy winter season on the West Coast.
CBS News Brief, I'm Wendy Gillette.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
The Brewers battle the Mets. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. It was the first game of the season, and already tempers flared between the Brewers and Mets in New York after Milwaukee's Rhys Hoskins slid hard into second base. Coverage on the Mets TV network.
A tough pickup from McNeil. They're called the out. They are. And then an overslide at second base by Hoskins. And we got some hard feelings as Hoskins has words. Both benches have emptied. The bullpens are joining it as well.
No punches were thrown. Milwaukee went on to win the game 3-1. Brewers manager Pat Murphy.
That shows what Rhys is about. He's a big league ball player. He's sending the message that even when you're not having the day you like at the plate, you know, I'm going to play hard.
The series wraps up this weekend, followed by the Brewers home opener on Tuesday. College basketball Marquette season came to a close after losing to NC State 67-58 in the NCAA's men's tournament. The Golden Eagles finish with a record of 27-10. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, showers and maybe a thunderstorm, a high near 49. Mostly cloudy tonight with a low around 35. More rain possible on Sunday, cloudy skies, 46. Rain likely Sunday night with a low around 38. For Monday, more rain, breezy, and 46.
Right now, it's 37.
Covering all the news that affects you with humor and a unique perspective. Matinair on Air with Jane Matinair. Weekdays 10 till noon on The Shaw. 101.1 FM and 540 AM WAUK and on the Civic Media app.
Are record energy costs putting a squeeze on your fixed or limited incomes? With inflation rising at record levels and incomes not keeping pace, you might be one of tens of thousands of Wisconsin residents who are struggling to survive in the blistering heat of summer or the bitter cold of winter. While you haven't asked for it, the Keep Wisconsin Warm Cool Fund and your local energy assistance providers are here to help. No Wisconsin resident should ever have to face the challenge of living without heat or power or face homelessness. For a hand up, apply today and call 1-800-506-5596. That's 800-506-5596. Or visit www.heat.help.
Save big money now at Menards. Menards has the best in-stock selection of AC2 pressure-treated decking and lumber. AC2 pressure-treated thick decking is 15% thicker than standard 1-inch decking, providing a stronger, more durable deck surface. Plus, get free estimates fast, in-store, or online with our deck design programs. And conveniently pick up your materials in our drive-through lumber yard. Head into Menards and get started on your deck project today.
Save big money at Menards.
You are listening to your local Civic Media radio station on air. Thank you. Did you know we are always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app too? And if you miss a show or game, find it wherever you get your podcasts or on our website, civicmedia.us.
Broadcasting to Waukesha at 101.1 FM. Broadcasting to Southeast Wisconsin at 540 AM. This is The Shaw, WAUK.
This is Amicus, the Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. Thank you for staying with me this hour as we talk about orders entered by judges to attempt as best they can to preserve the integrity of proceedings going on. Judge Juan Merchan scheduling an April 15th trial date for the so-called hush money or catch and kill case, now scheduled to go to trial on that date in a Manhattan criminal courtroom. And along the way, in the wake of his scheduling that trial to begin in mid-April, also entering an order on Tuesday that prohibits Donald Trump from attacking witnesses and jurors, the latest effort, if you will, to try to rein in the former president's rhetoric about his legal opponents and people who are involved in the justice system. Under the judge's order, Donald Trump cannot make or direct others to make statements about witnesses' roles in the case. He's also barred from commenting on prosecutors, court staff, and their relatives if he intends to interfere with their work on the case. Any comments whatsoever about jurors are banned as well. And the judge cites an array of hostile remarks that Donald Trump had made about grand jurors, prosecutors, and others. There's a notable exception to this so-called order that limits the amount of colorful language that Donald Trump can use. Trump is not prohibited from attacking Alvin Bragg himself, who has received numerous death threats, of course, as you know, in recent months. Bragg voluntarily carved himself out of his request to the judge to enter this order. In other Trump cases, prosecutors are also left out of those gag orders. This particular order, entered by Judge Merchan, hews very closely to the terms of another order that I made reference to. That is the one that has recently been upheld by a federal appeals court in Washington. That was the one that was entered by Tanya Chutkan in the election, the federal election interference trial, now suspended while the Supreme Court decides on the immunity issues. Along the way, the federal appeals court in that case said Trump's documented pattern of speech and its demonstrated real-time, real-world consequences pose a significant an imminent threat. And indeed, we know a lot about this. The kinds of things that Judge Merchan, that Tanya Chutkan, indeed Justice Engoron also wrestled with when it comes to the kinds of things that Donald Trump inappropriately says about virtually everybody involved in the criminal justice system. Trump previously has taken aim at Michael Cohen, of course, who's going to be one of the principal fat witnesses in this case, one-time fixer, his lawyer at one point, and he's called him a liar. He's called him a rat. Instead of a rambling and a fairly angry post on social media just this past week, Trump made an ominous reference to Michael Cohen, claiming without some explanation, some clarity on this, that his former lawyer was deaf. He also referred to one of Mr. Bragg's prosecutors in pejorative terms. And all of that comes in the midst of the defendants also posting on social media some references to the judge's own daughter. Those also much bandied about in the national media these days, which raises the issue about what will happen when the judge, again, reconvenes this coming week. Trump has also called other judges, including Justice Engoron, again, in the valuation case, called him a nut job. He's targeted prosecutors in virtually all of his criminal cases. He's accused him of falsely working in concert with President Biden. And he's called the DA himself a racist. All of that as a part of the overall record that Judge Merchan looks at and says, we cannot be having this. And so imposes this limited order that first and foremost is intended once again to ensure that witnesses and jurors and court staff and everybody else affiliated with the delivery of justice in this case, whatever it may be, are not the targets and are not affected by this kind of thing. As I said before, it is the expectation of every other criminal defendant in America, in every state prosecution, in any federal prosecution. There is nothing special about restrictions at all being placed upon Donald Trump. And that's part of my objection to this, that we need to enter a special order or a series of orders, as Judge Chutkan has done, as Justice Engoron has done, as now as Judge Merchan has done, to establish what is known out there. This behavior is inappropriate. It is contrary to the rule of law and cannot be tolerated. The question then, of course, is just this. What does Judge Merchan do? as we go forward here. It is also significant to note, as the justices and judges have done when they've reviewed these cases in the past, to find that this is not a violation of Donald Trump's First Amendment rights. He can, in fact, get out there and say that he is not guilty of the offense conduct. He can maintain that the facts will show that he cannot be found guilty beyond a reasonable doubt by a unanimous jury. He can make those general comments. What he cannot do is talk about the individual defendants, individual witnesses. He cannot talk about co-defendants either. He should not be talking about jurors and all those kinds of things that would potentially infect the very process. That's what these orders prevent him from doing. And again, they're simply articulations of orders not violated not prohibited at all by the First Amendment. These are things that are assumed to be the regular conduct of every defendant who is out there in our criminal courts these days. The reference to gag orders, once again, no one is being gagged here. Donald Trump can, in fact, speak, and he can talk during the course of his own campaign about issues that are important to him in the pursuit of the presidency. None of that restricted by any of these orders entered now by Judge Mershon, Judge Engoron, and also by Judge Chutkan. None of that prohibited in the political domain. Things related to the trials themselves, absolutely. And once again, not violative of the First Amendment, no free speech violations here at all, and attempts by the judges to ensure that the integrity of the system is established. It is also important to note that at some point, as Bill and others have indicated, that the attorneys also have some responsibility here. The judge's recent order protecting prospective jurors in the case effectively also barred Trump from exposing their entities, emphasizing the need to protect those who might decide this highly, highly important case. He also ordered that their addresses be kept secret from everyone except the lawyers in the case. And it's in that context that Bill's comment, again, is very significant. In an unrelated order on Tuesday, the same time, Judge Mershon issued a stern warning to the Trump lawyers as well. He reminded them to behave professionally or risk being held in contempt. Here is what he said. Here is what Judge Mershon said to the lawyers in that case. He said, "This court emphasizes that it hopes for and fully expects zealous advocacy from counsel, as well as spirited contribution from witnesses and parties alike." That's Judge Mershon writing in this case. He goes on to say this, however. "Nonetheless, the court expects that the line between zealous advocacy and willful disregard of its orders will not be crossed." That's the point that Bill was making before about the involvement of attorneys to enforce what the judges are saying, and also their own obligations as officers of the court to follow those very, not restrictions, but simply guide rails to ensure that the legitimacy of the trial is protected going forward. The all-important question, not only in the case pending before Judge Tanya Chutkan, the case that's now concluded in front of Judge Engoron, in which he did, in fact, fine Donald Trump several thousand dollars for violating the orders, not limiting but imposing legitimate restrictions on him, that case, and now this one. The question is, what does Judge Mershon do in the coming week and weeks going forward? There is the argument already made that Donald Trump has already violated the very terms and conditions of the order imposed just this past week. What are the remedies available to Judge Mershon going forward here? One of them, again, is fines. He can certainly impose monetary fines against the defendant, including fines against counsel if they likewise violate these rules. And yes, indeed, if indeed the nature of the violation of these orders is significant enough, there can be a finding of contempt. And depending upon the nature of the contempt, there's criminal contempt, there's civil contempt. One of the remedies available to a judge is imprisonment, is jailing. And one can purge oneself of that contempt by promising to behave, to be good, if you will, in the language of grade schoolers. But that is one of the remedies that is out there. And we will see what Judge Mershon does in the coming days, even in the wake of the things that Donald Trump has said about the judge's daughter, about other people involved in this case. arguably violative of the order entered by Judge Michonne just this past week. Important comments made by Bill, important comments made by other callers, including Dick, who's calling in from Madison. Dick, appreciate your inquiry here today as well.
Well, this is off topic, I know, but you know how we would not be talking about this man whatsoever? In the 60s, during the Civil Rights Movement, I think we fumbled the ball when we didn't go all the way and go after the Electoral College. That you talk about not getting the courts we like or we deserve. How about not even getting the candidate elected that we elected? He lost by over 3 million votes to Hillary Clinton. And this nonsense that you have, this archaic thing on the books yet, it just drives me crazy. The Civil Rights Movement should have dealt with it in the 60s. And everybody keeps telling me, oh, this can never happen, Dick. Why not? The Republicans went after Roe v. Wade. Now I realize I'll probably never live to see what I'd like to see, where one person, one vote. But I don't know why somebody doesn't address it at some point, because the guy would be totally irrelevant. We wouldn't even be discussing him.
Dick, points very well made. A couple of thoughts on that, very much in support of your observations. One is, yes, it was put into our Constitution by James Madison and George Mason, other people. It is a part of our Constitution. So to remedy this, we need a constitutional amendment. Can that be done, Dick? Sure it can. You need passage by both houses of Congress. You need the states to ratify it. And we can remove the Electoral College by a constitutional amendment. I know that you and others, and I included, will talk about how difficult that may be in this present environment. There's a process for doing it, and I agree with you that the whole concept has become anachronistic. It was put in place at a time, again, when we did not have a nation of 330 million people populating states across the country. And again, this notion of one man and one woman, one person, one vote. That's been implicit in the decisions of our Supreme Court, of other judges throughout our history. And that includes, of course, the civil rights history to which you make reference. So I concur in your view that we are getting results here, not just in the recent 2016 election, but in other elections as well, in which the Electoral College delivers a presidency that is not consistent with the overall vote of Americans. Advocacy continues, and Dick, the way you do that is continue to speak out about that on this broadcast and certainly in the community generally. There may come a time in American history when we tire of this anachronistic mechanism inside the Electoral College. We know well there are arguments to keep it in place. The time has come, I agree with you, Dick, to move on and do the one-person, one-vote approach that contemplates a vote in November and the swearing-in in January of a candidate who's gotten the majority votes from all Americans in our nation. We've been talking a lot this morning about what's going on in Manhattan, these two cases pending in a civil court, in a criminal court. We're going to spend some time also in our remaining moments in our weekend broadcast talking about what's going on in Georgia. We're going to go south here for a while. You may recall that this is the RICO case brought by Fannie Willis through two grand juries that indict Donald Trump and 19 defendants altogether. Four of them have already pled guilty to various counts under this RICO, this omnibus sweeping indictment, alleging that they engaged in election interference in the state of Georgia that robbed Georgia voters of the opportunity to elect the candidate, to send electors in that electoral college to Washington in the way that they intended to do. Now, in the end, their efforts were not successful, as we know. And so Georgia's electoral votes do, in fact, reflect the fact that Joe Biden won Georgia. But Fannie Willis, in that case, brought this omnibus indictment against Donald Trump and others, alleging their interference. And we're going to continue to talk about what happened just this past week in that case, now pending in front of a state court judge there in Fulton County, as we discuss further the processes and procedures of criminal prosecution in the courts of America.
You're listening to The Shaw at WAUK, Waukesha's home for the Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
Keeping you informed, entertained, and connected to your local community. Here's Terry Barr with the Civic Media Radio Network.
Did you know there's a group focusing on the importance of the arts in Wisconsin? Create Wisconsin is a nonprofit based in Madison and trying to expand thinking about the arts and the economy.
Everybody wants their community to be vibrant and healthy and have people visit and live there. And so we try to help people figure out what they need, and then we figure out how we can help them.
Ann Katz is the director of Create Wisconsin, and she says the work really took off when the group learned the Badger State is in last place when it comes to arts funding and support.
It's an investment in people, businesses, organizations, and communities. People are really hungry for that authentic, unique. Mm-hmm. That's what we try to nurture and to assist.
Learn more about Create Wisconsin and some upcoming events where you can get involved. Go to createwisconsin.org. Until next time, I'm Terry Barr.
You're listening to The Shaw, WAUK.
I'm Terry Barr.
You're listening to The Shaw, WAU.
This is Amicus, a law review. Thank you for joining me in our discussion of all things courts. Lots of things going on in the courts of our nation, including a court, a criminal court in Fulton County, Georgia, presided over by Judge Scott McAfee of the Fulton County Superior Court. He did a couple of things this past week that also have an impact upon that criminal prosecution, that state RICO criminal prosecution against Donald Trump and many others. First, we know that in previous weeks, the judge has entered some orders, most notably an order dismissing six of the counts in that indictment, alleging that the grand jury and the prosecutor had failed to provide sufficient notice, sufficient information to justify those counts going forward. And he'd also found in another, even much more notorious and famous ruling there, that there was no actual conflict of interest in permitting Fannie Willis to continue to prosecute the case. He did, however, find that a romance that she had with one of her top prosecutors in that case created an appearance of impropriety, justifying, therefore, that top prosecutor leave the prosecution team, which he did do. That was his order entered fairly recently to the attention of virtually all of American media and all of you as well. Well, just this past week, Donald Trump noticed his appeal of that particular order, calling the Atlanta prosecutor Fannie Willis utterly unrepentant. Lawyers for Donald Trump and eight of the co-defendants, and they're along for the ride on this as well, in this Georgia election interference case, have now asked an appeals court to reverse the judge's ruling that allowed her to stay on the case. And that is significant because, once again, we've got another appeal of a pretrial order, this one again in Georgia. And the question is, will that prevent the case from going forward? Well, we know that the judge in that case, Scott McAfee, has already issued a certificate basically of entitlement, a certificate of authorization to permit that appeal to go forward. And along the way, he did say that he has given permission for the defendants to pursue that appeal. But under Georgia law, the co-defendants have to also secure the approval of the appeals court. The appeals court has got to say, much like the Supreme Court does, that they're going to take the case before the matter can be heard by a panel of presumably three appellate judges there in Georgia. The appeals court has 45 days to decide whether to grant or deny the appeal application that's now been filed just this past week. And again, the question is whether or not that will hold, and the appeals court will basically put on hold what is going on in front of Judge McAfee. Highly unlikely that would happen, because Judge McAfee is also entertaining at the same time pretrial motions, and he has had a hearing just this past week on the pretrial motions submitted by the defendants in this case seeking to dismiss the case entirely. First court hearing since this fairly significant ruling finding that Fulton County DA Fannie Willis can remain on the case, and the hearing, again, focusing upon these motions filed by the defense challenging the indictment generally. Trump lawyer Stephen Sadow said that the majority of the overt acts set forth in the indictment involve false statements or tweets which are clearly political speech And he indicated that all of these things are protected by the First Amendment. He argued that as the attorney for Donald Trump, that Trump's claims of election, claims of election fraud, and even his efforts to contact election officials were amid this fake elector scheme, merits protection under the First Amendment. They should not be the subjects of criminal prosecution, but are protected by the First Amendment. He called the conduct of Donald Trump in this particular case, as alleged in the indictment, the zenith of protected speech. Once again, this raising this notion that Donald Trump, in this case, for the things that he has said, should not be the subject of criminal prosecution, but protected by the First Amendment. He said, the attorney said, what do we have here? We have election speech. He argued that Trump's statements weren't, as alleged in the indictment, to steal the election in an unlawful fashion, but instead was a public service as a part of his office. Those were the arguments made by the attorneys for Donald Trump just this past week. Some of the expressions on Judge McAfee's face, although he did not rule on the motions this past week, indicated that he was skeptical of those positions and indeed probably going to come down on the side of the prosecutors now continuing to prosecute this case. And among them is Senior District Attorney Donald Wakeford, plainly unpersuaded by the arguments by the defense attorney. He accused Trump's team of fundamentally rewriting the indictment. And he cited a previous ruling by who? By Tanya Chutkan in that January 6th federal case, rejecting those arguments explicitly. This is the very same argument that Tanya Chutkan rejected, that the appeals court in D.C. rejected, and that is now before the United States Supreme Court. In that case, it's going to be argued in April. It's this notion that somehow, First Amendment and immunity, other things prevent the prosecutions from going ahead. Tanya Chutkan explicitly also rejected the notion, in addition to the immunity notion, that the First Amendment protects these kinds of statements. The attorney said that Trump is allowed to make false statements in many circumstances, including in the political domain. What he is not allowed to do, and the reason why this criminal prosecution is here, the attorney said, is to employ his speech and his expression as a part of a criminal conspiracy. There's a difference between those two things. He's not being prosecuted for lying, the attorney for the state said. He's being prosecuted for lying to the government, referencing this very complex racketeering charge involving efforts to pressure state officials there to produce a slate of electors for Trump that would claim that he was the official victor in 2020. And again, this legal face-off comes after Willis said her team was continuing its efforts to prosecute. Plainly, Judge McAfee has given us the answer by virtue of the very conduct of these hearings that he is not waiting. He is not waiting for the Court of Appeals to decide the issue about disqualification. He is going ahead, and he is going to be deciding these cases, the merits of them, not waiting for the Court of Appeals, and instead going to continue to oversee these cases as they go forward, all that pending in front of Judge Scott McAfee. Determining whether or not indeed the comments made by Donald Trump were the zenith of protected speech, or much more likely, as the prosecutor's attorney said, not protected, but a part of a criminal conspiracy. A programming note for next week, we're going to chat more about lawyers since we talked a lot about them this past broadcast. We're going to talk about John Eastman and other lawyers. We're also going to talk about Sam Bankman-Fried just this past week, sentenced to a 25-year term for his violation of the criminal law. All of that coming up on our next weekend weekly broadcast of Amicus, a Law Review. Join us for that discussion going forward. Have a good week, everybody.
Home for the Devil's Advocates.
Weekday afternoons from 4 until 6.
On The Shaw, 540 AM and 101.1 FM, WAUK.
Hey everybody, Todd Allball. Monday noon to 2, it's the Cheese, Beer, and Radio Tour starting in Richland Center with Trey V. Olson. Don't miss it on the Civic Media Radio Network.
This message is for Shauna, my mom, who just finished her high school diploma. I wanted to say I'm so proud of you for finishing school. You taught me it's never too late to achieve your dreams. I hope to make you as proud as you have made me.
When you graduate, they graduate. Finish your high school diploma for you and for them. Visit finishyourdiploma.org to find free and supportive adult education centers near you. Brought to you by the Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
You are listening to The Shaw.
WAUK 540 AM Jackson. W266 DR Waukesha.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Wendy Gillespie.